And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I've gotten a number of emails wanting to know if I knew anything about these stimulus checks that Congress is going to be sending out. And I went and checked, and I'm going to try to answer the questions I was asked. First, who's eligible? Tax filers? Yes, you have to file a tax return. With adjusted gross income up to $75,000 for an individual and $150,000 for married couples, we'll get the full payment. That's $1,200 per person per adult and $500 per child, up to about $3,500 for a family of four. Now, the vast majority of people don't need to take any action. The IRS is going to calculate and automatically send the payment to those eligible. For those who've already filed their 2019 tax returns, the IRS is going to use this information to calculate the payment amount. And those who haven't filed yet, IRS will use information from their 2018 tax filing to calculate the payment. Now, the IRS doesn't have everybody's direct deposit information. In the coming weeks, Treasury is going to develop a web-based portal for individuals to provide their banking information to the IRS online so those payments can be sent directly. Apparently, they're not going to use paper checks. And for those that are not normally required to file a tax return, they can still get payments. They'll need to file a simple return to get an economic impact payment. Low-income taxpayers, senior citizens, Social Security recipients, some veterans, individuals with disabilities who are not otherwise required to file a tax return. You're not going to owe any taxes, but this gives them the information they need. It's going to be at irs.gov/coronavirus, and that site will provide information telling people how to file a 2019 tax return with simple but necessary information, including their filing status, number, dependents, direct deposit, bank information, things such as that. Now, there's a lot of people saying that they're getting phone calls from folks identifying themselves as being from Social Security or some other agency wanting banking information so that stimulus payments can be made electronically. These are, for the most part, bogus calls. They're just trying to get your banking information. Now, folks who haven't filed a return for 2018 or 2019, if you've got a tax obligation but you haven't filed, you need to do so as soon as you can to get the economic impact payment. And taxpayers should provide direct deposit banking information on the return. Now, for those concerned about visiting a tax professional, local community organization in person to help with the tax return, these impact payments will be available throughout the rest of 2020. And as I say, irs.gov/coronavirus, as soon as that site becomes available, and it's not yet up, or it wasn't a few minutes ago, the IRS is going to post all this information. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, now today's April 1st, April Fool's Day, and there are a lot of information on the internet about April Fools, also called All Fools Day. And there's an annual custom on this particular day. You play practical jokes or hoaxes on friends and acquaintances. And then most people expose their actions by shouting April Fools at the recipient. And, you know, mass media can be involved in these pranks. You know, today's not a public holiday in any country except Odessa in Ukraine, where April 1st is an official city holiday. And the custom of setting aside one particular day to play pranks on your neighbors it's been relatively common in the world. There's a disputed association between April 1st and foolishness in Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, which came out in 1392. Also in the Nun's Priest Tale of Vane Cock Chanticleer's Trick by a Fox on Sin March Biggin 30 Days and Two. And readers apparently understood that reference to mean March 32nd, which is actually April 1st. Well, it's not really clear if Chaucer was actually referencing April 1st, but that's the assumption. Now, in 1508, there was a French poet named Elroy de Merval, referred to a Poisson d'Avril, April Fool, really Fish of April. That's the first reference to the celebration in France. It's been suggested April Fools originated because in the Middle Ages, New Year's Day was celebrated on March 25th in most European towns, with a holiday in some areas of France specifically ended on April 1st. And those who celebrated New Year's Eve on January 1st made fun of those who celebrated on other dates by the invention of April Fool's Day. Now, the use of January 1st as New Year's Day became common in France only in the mid-16th century. That date wasn't adopted officially as New Year's Day until 1564 by the Edict of Rousselon. 1561, Flemish poet Edouard de Denay wrote of a nobleman who sent his servants on foolish errands on April 1st. In the Netherlands, the origin of April Fool's Day is often attributed to the Dutch victory in 1572 at Brielle, where the Spanish Duke Alvarez de Toledo was defeated. In 1686, John Aubrey referred to the celebration as Fool's Holy Day, the first British reference. April 1st, 1698, several people were tricked into going to the Tower of London to see the lions get washed. They didn't have any lions. And although no biblical scholar or historian is known to have mentioned a relationship, some have expressed a belief that the origin of April Fool's Day may go back to the Genesis flood narrative. It was discussed in a 1908 edition of Harper's Weekly. Now, in the UK, an April Fool prank is sometimes later revealed by shouting April Fool at the recipient, who becomes the April Fool. A study in the 1950s by folklorist Iona and Peter Opie found it in the UK and in countries whose traditions derive from the UK, the joke ceased at midday. And this continues to be the current practice, with the custom ceasing at noon, after which time it's no longer acceptable to play these pranks. So a person playing a prank after midday is considered the April Fool themselves. In Scotland, April Fool's Day was traditionally called Huntingauk Day, although the name has fallen into disuse. The name's a corruption of Hunt the Gowk, Gowk being Scots for a cuckoo or a foolish person. Alternative terms in Gaelic would be Gowking Day, or the day of running the cuckoo. Traditional prank is to ask someone to deliver a sealed message as opposed to request help of some sort. In fact, the message reads, "Dinna laugh, dinna smile, hunt the gowk another mile." Well, the recipient, upon reading it, will explain he can only help if the person delivered it first contacts another person, and sends the victim to the next person with an identical message that has the same result. In Ireland, it was traditional to entrust the victim with an important letter to be given to a named person. And the person would read the letter and then ask the victim to take it on to somebody else and so on. The in Poland, Prima Aprilis, or April 1st in Latin, was as a day for pranks is a centuries-long tradition. It's a day when many pranks are played. Hoaxes, sometimes very sophisticated, are prepared by people, media, which often cooperate to make the information more credible, and even public institutions. Serious activities are normally avoided on this date. Generally, every word said on April 1st can be untrue. The conviction for this is so strong that the Polish anti-Turkish alliance with Leopold I signed on April 1st, 1683, was backdated to March 31st. For some in Poland, Prima Aprilis ends at noon on April 1st. In the Nordic countries, the Danes, the Finns, the Icelanders, the Norwegians, and the Swedes celebrate April Fool's Day. Most news media outlets have published exactly one false story on April 1st. For newspapers, this would typically be a first-page article, but not the top headline. In Italy, France, Belgium, and French-speaking areas of Switzerland and Canada, April 1st tradition is known as April Fish. This includes attempting to attach a paper fish to the victim's back without being noticed. Such fish featuring is prominently present on many late 19th and early 20th century April Fool's Day postcards. Then in Ukraine, as I said earlier, April Fool's Day is actually a holiday. It's got the special local name of Humorina. For the first time, this holiday arose in 1973. April Fool's prank is revealed by saying in Russian, April 1st, trust nobody at the recipient. The festivities include a large parade in the city center, free concerts, street fairs, and performances. In Lebanon, an April Fool's prank is revealed by saying April 1st lie at the recipient. In many Spanish-speaking countries and the Philippines, Dia de los Santos Inocentes, Holy Innocents Day, is a festivity which is very similar to the April Fool's Day, but it's celebrated in late December. In Israel, as a Western country, they've adopted the custom of pranking folks on April Fool's Day. The, you know, as well as people playing pranks on one another on April Fool's, elaborate pranks have appeared on radio and TV stations, newspapers, websites, been performed by large corporations. One famous prank in 1957, the BBC broadcast a film in their Panorama Current Affairs series purporting to show Swiss farmers picking freshly grown spaghetti in what they called the Swiss spaghetti harvest. BBC was later flooded with a request to purchase a spaghetti plant, which forced them to declare the film a hoax on the news the next day. With the advent of the internet and readily available global news services, April Fool's pranks can catch and embarrass a wider audience than ever before. You know, December 28th, that's the equivalent day in Spain, Hispanic America, and the Philippines, is also the Christian day of celebration of the Day of the Holy Innocents. It's a religious holiday in its own right, but the tradition of pranks is not, though the latter is observed yearly. In some regions of Hispanic America, after a prank is played, the cry is made, "You innocent little dove that let yourself be fooled." Not really confused with another meaning of palomita, which means popcorn in some dialects. In Mexico, the phrase is inocente para siempre, which means innocent forever. In Argentina, the prankster says, que lo inocia te valga, which roughly translates as advice not to be as gullible as the victim of the prank. In Spain, it's common to say inocente, which is Spanish, can mean innocent or gullible. In Colombia, the term used is let it go. Today's it's Innocence Day. In Belgium, the day is known as the Day of the Innocent Children or Day of the Stupid Children. Used to be a day where parents, grandparents, and teachers would fool children in some way, but celebration of this day has died out in favor of April Fool's Day. Nevertheless, on the Spanish island of Menorca, Fooling Day is celebrated April 1st because Menorca was a British possession during part of the 18th century. Well, the practice of April Fool's pranks and hoaxes is controversial. The mixed opinions of critics are epitomized in the reception to the 1957 BBC Spaghetti Tree hoax, in reference to which newspapers are split over whether it was a great joke or a terrible hoax on the public. Of course, a spaghetti tree in the backyard would not be a bad thing. The positive view is that April Fool's can be good for one's health because it encourages jokes, hoaxes, pranks, and belly laughs, and brings all the benefits of laughter, including a stress relief and reducing strain on the heart. And there are many best of April Fool's Day lists that are compiled in order to showcase the best examples of how that day is celebrated. Various April Fool's campaigns have been praised for their innovation, creativity, writing, and general effort. The negative view describes April Fool's hoaxes as creepy and manipulative, rude and a little bit nasty, as well as based on schadenfreude and deceit. When genuine news or a genuinely important order or warning is issued on April Fool's Day, there is a risk it'll be misinterpreted as a joke and ignored. For example, when Google, known to play elaborate April Fool's Day hoaxes, announced the launch of Gmail with one gigabyte inboxes in 2004, an era when competing webmail services offered 4 megabytes or less, was dismissed as a joke. On the other hand, sometimes stories intended as jokes are taken seriously. Either way, there can be adverse effects, such as confusion, misinformation, waste of resources, even legal or commercial consequences. People obeying hoax messages telephone Mr. C. Lyon or Mr. L. E. Font and such like on a telephone number. Turns out to be a zoo, sometimes causes a serious overload of the zoo's telephone switchboard. April 1st, 1946, warning about the Aleutian Islands earthquake tsunami that killed 165 people in Hawaii and Alaska was taken as a hoax. April 1st, 2005, news that the comedian Mitch Hedberg had died on March 29th, 2005, was taken as a hoax. April 1st, 2005, announcement about Powerpuff Girls Z by Aniplex, Cartoon Network, and Toei Animation was taken as a hoax. And April 1st, 2009, announcement that the long-running soap opera Guiding Light was being canceled was viewed by many as a hoax. You know, in books, films, telemovies, and television episodes, April Fool's Day has been used as their title and inspiration. Examples include Bryce Courtenay's novel, April Fool's Day, which title refers to the day Courtney's son died. And 1990 sitcom Roseanne featured an episode titled April Fool's Day. Turned out to be intentionally misleading as the episode was about tax day in the United States on April 15th. That's the last day to submit the previous year's tax information, though this year it has been extended to sometime in July, I think. Well, I talked about the Spaghetti Tree BBC program that ran in 1957. In 1962, Swedish national TV broadcast a 5-minute special on how one could get color TV by putting a nylon stocking in front of the TV. A rather in-depth description on the physics behind the phenomenon was included in the special. Thousands of people tried it. Then there's Smell-O-Vision. 1965, the BBC purported to conduct a trial of a new technology allowing the transmission of odor over the airwaves to all viewers. And many viewers reportedly contacted the BBC to report the trial's success. 2007, the BBC website repeated an online version of the hoax, as did Google in 2013. In 1969, public broadcaster NTS in the Netherlands announced that inspectors with remote scanners would drive the streets to detect people who hadn't paid their radio or TV tax. One way to prevent detection was to wrap the TV or radio in aluminum foil. The next day, all supermarkets were sold out of aluminum foil and a surge of TV radio taxes were being paid. Then there's the Great Blue Hill Eruption Prank. April 1st, 1980, Boston TV station WNAC aired a fake news bulletin at the end of the 6 o'clock news that reported that Great Blue Hill in Milton, Massachusetts was erupting like a volcano. The prank resulted in panic in Milton, where some residents began to flee their homes. The executive producer of the 6 o'clock news, Homer Silly, was fired by the station for his failure to exercise good news judgment and for violating the FCC's rules about showing stock footage without identifying it as such. 1989, on the BBC television sports show Grandstand, a fight broke out between members of staff directly behind Des Lynam, who was commenting on the professionalism of his team. Of course, at the end of the show, it was revealed that it was an April Fool's prank. In 2008, the BBC reported on a newly discovered colony of flying penguins. An elaborate video segment was even produced, featuring Terry Jones walking with the penguins in Antarctica and following their flight to the Amazon rainforest. Then Netflix had an April Fool's joke, including over-detailing categories of films and adding original program made up entirely of food cooking. Man, wouldn't that just burn you up? Then there have been some radio stations who have aired pranks. Jovian Plutonian Gravitational Effect. 1976, British astronomer Sir Patrick Moore told listeners of BBC Radio 2 that the unique alignment of two planets could result in an upward gravitational pull, making people lighter at precisely 9:47 a.m. that day. Invited his audience to jump in the air and experience a strange floating sensation. Dozens of listeners phoned in to say the experiment had been highly successful. Among them, a woman who reported that she and her 11 friends were wafted from their chairs and orbited gently around the room. I think somebody was delving into the cannabis. In 1998, local WAAF shock jock Opie and Anthony were discussing April Fool's Day hoax and sardonically stated that Boston Mayor Thomas Menino had been killed in a car accident. Well, he happened to be on a flight at the time, which lent credence to the prank, as nobody could reach him. The pair repeated the mayor was dead several times throughout the broadcast. However, listeners who tuned in late to the broadcast didn't hear that they were repeating a bit, and then they pretended to tell the news to an unsuspecting listener. The rumor spread across town, eventually causing news stations to issue alerts denying the hoax. Well, the pair of shock jocks were fired shortly after that. Then in 1998, UK presenter Nick Tuff of West Midlands radio station pretended to be the British Prime Minister Tony Blair when he called in the then South African president Nelson Mandela for a chat. It was only at the end of the call when Nick asked Mandela what he was doing for April Fool's Day that the line went dead. Then BBC Radio 4 in 2005, the Today program, announced in the news the long-running serial The Archers had changed its theme tune to an upbeat disco style. Certainly not an earth-shaking announcement. Then National Public Radio in the U.S., the producers of Morning Edition, or All Things Considered, annually include a fictional news story. Now, these usually start off more or less reasonably and get more and more unusual. In 2006, the story is about the iPod, a portable body control device. 2008 reported the IRS to assure rebate checks were actually spent were shipping consumer products instead of checks. It also runs false sponsor mentions, such as support for NPR comes from the Soylent Corporation, manufacturing protein-rich fruit products in a variety of colors. Well, Soylent Green is people. There was a movie by that name. Canadian $3 coin. In 2008, the CBC radio program As It Happens interviewed a rural Canadian mint spokesman who broke news of plans to replace the Canadian $5 bill with a $3 coin. The coin was dubbed a Threeny, in line with the nicknames of the country's $1 coin. Loony, due to its depiction of a common loon on the reverse, and the $2 coin, which was called the Toonie. Well, Country and Gospel, WIXE in Monroe, North Carolina, does a prank every year. In 2009, midday host Bob Rogers announced he was changing his show to heavy metal. This resulted in numerous phone calls from about half the listeners wanting to request a specific song. U2 live on rooftop in Cork. 2009, hundreds of U2 fans were duped in an elaborate prank when they rushed to a shopping center in Cork, believing the band was playing a surprise rooftop concert. Prank was organized by Cork radio station Red FM. The band was a tribute band called Utopia. In 2000, a Triple J breakfast show hosted by Adam Spencer announced the International Olympic Committee had stripped Sydney of its right to host the 2000 Summer Olympics. Then they had a phone conversation with the then New South Wales Premier, Bob Carr. In 1993, a radio station in San Diego, California, told listeners the space shuttle had been diverted to a small local airport. Well, over 1,000 people drove out to the airport to see it arrive in the middle of the morning rush hour. Well, what should have clued everybody in, it was a hoax. There was no shuttle in the air at that time. Well, the Scientific American columnist Martin Gardner wrote in an April 1975 article, NIT had invented a new chess computer program that predicted pawn to queen's rook 4 is always the best opening move. Not exactly an earth-shaking prank, but in the Guardian newspaper in the UK on April Fool's Day, 1977, a fictional mid-ocean state of sans-serif was created in a 7-page supplement. And all those who wanted to go there and see what was going on was somewhat disappointed. In a 1985 issue of Sports Illustrated, April 1st, it featured a story by George Plimpton on a baseball player, Hayden Siddhartha Finch, a New York Mets pitching prospect who could throw the ball 168 miles an hour. And had a number of eccentric quirks, such as playing with one bare foot and one hiking boot. Plimpton later expanded that piece into a full-length novel on Finch's life. Sports Illustrated cited the story as one of the more memorable in the magazine's history. I don't see what the prank was, but that's just me. Associated Press were fooled in 1983 when Joseph Boskin, a professor of history at Boston University, provided an alternative explanation for the origin of April Fool's Day. He claimed to have traced the practice to Constantine's period when a group of court jesters jocularly told the emperor that jesters could do a better job of running the empire, and the amused emperor nominated a jester named Kugel to be king for a day. Boskin related how the jester passed an edict calling for absurdity on that day, and the custom became an annual event. Boskin explained the jester's role as being able to put serious matters into perspective with humor. An Associated Press article brought this alternative explanation to the public's attention in newspapers, not knowing that Boskin had invented the entire story as an April Fool joke and wasn't made aware of this till some weeks later. Then we have, in 1996, Taco Bell took out a full-page ad in 7 major newspapers and announced that they had purchased the Liberty Bell to reduce the country's debt and renamed it the Taco Liberty Bell. When asked about the sale, White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry replied, tongue-in-cheek, that the Lincoln Memorial had also been sold and henceforth being known as the Lincoln Mercury Memorial. That's probably not a bad idea. In 2008, Car and Driver, an automobile magazine, both reported Toyota had acquired the rights to the defunct Oldsmobile brand from General Motors, intended to relaunch it with a lineup of rebadged Toyota SUVs positioned between its mainline Toyota and luxury Lexus brands. Then on the internet, in 1984, in one of the earliest online hoaxes, a message was circulated that Usenet had been open to users in the Soviet Union. I'm not sure what the hoax was about that, but April Fool's Day request for comments. Almost every year in 1989, the Internet Engineering Task Force has included an April Fool in the request for comments publication, including a hypertext coffee pot control protocol and electricity over IP, kind of like voice over IP. For decades, printed college newspapers run stories about their respective institutions changing to a ridiculous or silly new athletics mascot. In the internet age, the practice has moved to online editions and into the social media pages of fan bases and alumni associations. 2007, an illusion designer for magicians posted on his website some images illustrating the corpse of an unknown 8-inch creation. This was claimed to be the mummified remains of a fairy. He later sold the fairy on eBay for £280. Now, Google's well known for the annual April Fool's jokes, which they've done in 2000, 2002, and every year since 2004, except 2020. In 2015, Bing launched a pretend new product called the Cute Cloud that acted as a hub to cute animal videos and GIFs, photos. 2016, the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts, Glenn Hegar, sent a message on Twitter Texas would issue its own currency for the first time since 1845. 2009, a flying hotel is purportedly about to take off from New York. The hoax was organized by a marketing company for a hotel search site. In 2016, one of the biggest pornography sharing sites, Pornhub, changed its name to Cornhub and displayed suggestive videos featuring corn. It was kind of like the Roman senator who said, lend me your ears. The site used a similar prank for 2018's April Fool's Day, this time changing its name to Hornhub and displaying videos about women blowing horns instead of pornography. In 2020, news site Morning Peninsula published a joke article stating April Fool's Day had been canceled due to the corona outbreak, and the day would instead take place on September 1st. Ironically, after this article was published, multiple other outlets published genuine articles suggesting April Fool's Day should be canceled. Then hashtag Give Thanks Not Pranks began to trend on Twitter, and multiple companies announced they were canceling their traditional April Fool's Day pranks out of respect. Well, Synetics advertised write-only memory, ICs, in their data books in 1972 through the late 1970s. Well, now, Google has been an interesting originator of April Fool's Day pranks. Google's first April 1st Day hoax, the Mentalplex hoax, invited users to project a mental image of what they wanted to find while staring at an animated GIF. Several humorous error messages were displayed on the search results page. Error 005. KUT weak or no signal detected. Upgrade transmitter and retry. Error 466. Multiple. Now remember, these are mental projections. Multiple transmitters detected. Silence voices in your head and try again. Error 05. Brainwaves received in analog. Please rethink in digital. Error 4P. Unclear on whether your search is about money or monkeys. Try again. Error 445. Searching on this topic is prohibited under international law. Error CK8, that information is protected under the National Security Act. Error 104, that information was lost with the Martian lander. Try again. Error 007. Clarity is unclear. Try again after removing hat, glasses, and shoes. What's interesting is a lot of people apparently did this. Error 008. Interference detected. Remove aluminum foil and remote control devices. Error. Insufficient conviction. Clap hands three times while chanting, I believe, and try it again. And number 11, mental plex has determined this is not your final answer. Try one more time. An additional error message was included to convert all navigation text to German, but it was scrapped after user complaints. In 2002, Google revealed the technology behind its PageRank system, PigeonRank. Google touts the benefits of this cost-effective and efficient means of ranking pages and reassures readers there's no animal cruelty involved in the process. The article makes many humorous references and puns based on computer terminology and how Google PageRank really works. 2004, fictitious job opportunities for a research center on the moon. Copernicus is the name of a new operating system they claim to have created for working at the research center. Google also announced Gmail on April 1st, an unprecedented, unbelievable free 1 gigabyte of space. The announcement of Gmail was written in an unserious, jokey language normally seen in April Fool's jokes, which tricked many people into thinking it was actually an April Fool's joke. 2005, the Google Gulp. A fictitious drink was announced by Google in 2005. According to the company, this beverage would optimize one's use of the Google search engine by increasing the drinker's intelligence. It's claimed this boost was achieved through real-time analysis of the user's DNA and carefully tailored adjustments to neurotransmitters in the brain. A patented technology termed auto-drink, as the Google Gulp FAQ suggests, partly through MAO inhibition. The drink was said to come in four great flavors. Glutamate grape, sugar radical, beta-carotene, and serotonic water. Now, this hoax is probably intended as a parody of Google's then-invite-only mail service called Gmail. Although ostensibly free, the company claimed the beverage could only be obtained by returning the cap to a Google Gulp bottle to a local grocery store. A catch-22. In the Google Gulp FAQ, Google replies to the observation, I mean, isn't this whole invite-only thing kind of bogus, by saying, dude, it's like you've never even heard of viral marketing. Well, in 2006, on April Fool's Day, Google Romance was announced as the main Google search page with the introduction, dating is a search problem. Solve it with Google Romance. It pretended to offer a soulmate search to send users on a contextual date. It was just a parody of online dating, but it had link for those who generally favor the throw-enough-stuff-at-the-wall approach to online dating to post multiple profiles with a bulk upload file. You sleaze in addition to post your Google Romance profile. Clicking on either of these gave an error page that explained it was an April Fool's joke and included links to previous April Fool's jokes. Then we got Gmail paper for 2007, about 10 p.m. Pacific time, where Google has its headquarters, on March 30th, 2007. Google changed the login page for Gmail to announce a new service called Gmail paper. The service offered to allow users of Google's free webmail service to add emails to a paper archive, which Google would print on 94% post-consumer organic soybean sputum, and mail via traditional post. The service would be free, supported by bold red advertisements printed on the back of the printed message. Image attachments would also be printed on high-quality glossy paper, though MP3 and WAV files couldn't be printed. The page detailed more information about the service features, photographs of Ian Spiro and Carrie Kemper, current employees of Google. Also featured are product marketing managers of Gmail, Anna Christina Douglas and Shane Lawrence. Then we have also for 2007, Google TISP, short for Top Interesting Served Provided Landscape, a fictitious free broadband service supposedly released by Google. This service will make use of a standard toilet and sewage lines to provide free internet connectivity at a speed of 8 megabytes per second. 2 megabytes upload and... or 32 megabytes with a paid plan. The user would drop a weighted end of a long Google-supplied fiber optic cable into their toilet and flush it. About 60 minutes later, the end would be recovered and connected to the internet by a plumbing hardware dispatcher. The user would then connect their end to a Google-supplied wireless router and run the Google-supplied installation media on Windows XP or Windows Vista. Alternatively, a user could request a professional installation, which Google would deploy nanobots through the plumbing to complete the process. The free service will be supported by a discrete DNA sequencing or personal body output to display online ads that relate to culinary preferences or personal health. Google also referenced the Diet Coke and Mentos reaction in their FAQ. They said if you're still experiencing problems, drop 8 mints into the bowl and add a 2-liter bottle of diet soda. They also claimed the enterprise plans would include support in the event of backup problems, brownouts, or and data wipes. Then in 2008, the Blogger dashboard featured an announcement for Google Weblogs, the next revolution in personal publishing. Features include algorithms putting the user's best content at the top of the user's blog rather than publishing by reverse chronology, automatically populating the blog sidebar with the most relevant context, posting directly into Google search results for maximum visibility, blog headers refreshed with images from Google's team of artists for anniversaries of a scientific achievement, and automatic content generation. And if you're not sure what to post about, just click I Feel Lucky and they'll take care of the rest. The announcement was followed by a link to a video tour of the product, which actually led to Tay Zonday's cover of Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up. Then there's Dajia. Google launches Dajia in Japan with the mission of organizing the world's laughter. Then Google announced Day in Australia, a new beta search technology that will search web pages 24 hours before they're created. Then Gmail sign-in page and a banner at the top of each Gmail inbox announced a new feature called Gmail Custom Time that would allow its user to predate their messages and choose to have the message appear as read or unread. The new feature uses the slogan, be on time every time. Around 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, March 31st, 2008, on the newer and older versions of Gmail, but not in the basic HTML version in the upper right-hand corner next to Settings, a link would appear labeled New, Gmail Custom Time. The link read to a 404 error until April 1st, when it led to the full Gmail Custom Time hoax page. Click any of the links, and you go to a page stating that Gmail Custom Time was, in fact, an April Fool's Day joke. Then the Google book search had a new section allowing users to scratch and sniff certain books. Users are asked to please place your nose near the monitor and click Go, which then loads odors. When clicking on Help, users are redirected to a page in the book that describes the origins of April Fool's Day. Then Google added the I'm Feeling Lucky button to its calendar feature. When the user tries to create a new event, the user is given the regular option of entering the correct details and hitting Create Event, and also the new option of I'm Feeling Lucky, which would set the user up with an evening date with, among others, Matt Damon, Eric Cartman, Tom Cruise, Jessica Alba, Pamela Anderson, Paris Hilton, Angelina Jolie, Britney Spears, Anna Kournikova, Johnny Depp, George W. Bush, or Lois Griffin. Then Google launched a manpower search in China. The feature was presented as being powered by 25 million volunteers who conducted searches around the clock. When the user entered a keyword, volunteers would search any possible answers from a mass of paper documents as well as online sources. The user was expected to get the search results within 32 seconds. But the search button would avoid the user's cursor. Then Google Korea announced that Google Satori had been opened on April 1st, 2008. When the user tried to use this translator, a message appeared explaining it was April Fool's Day and not executable. Then there's Google Talk. They announced plans on April 22nd, 2008, to shorten all conversations on Google Talk, thereby reducing the energy required to transmit chats in an effort to reduce carbon output. Then Google launched their Wake Up Kit as a calendar notification option. Now, the Wake Up notification uses several progressively more annoying alerts to wake you up. The first is to send an SMS message to the phone. That fails, more coercive means to be used. The kit includes an industrial-sized bucket and is designed to be connected to their water main for automatic filling. In addition, a bed-flipping device is included for forceful removal from their sleeping quarters. Google does have a sense of humor, I gotta admit that. Then Google announced a joint project with the Virgin Group to establish a permanent human settlement on Mars. This operation has been named Project Virgil. The announcement includes videos of Richard Branson, founder of the Virgin Group, as well as Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, on YouTube talking about Virgil. An application to join a settlement includes questions such as, number one, I'm a world-class expert in physics, first aid, engineering, Guitar Hero 2. After the user submitted the application, a site notifies the user is not fit for space, or that the user's application is fine and all you have to do is submit your video as a response to their video on YouTube. As a result, an open source Virgil group has been established, Open Virgil. Then Yogurt, Google's Orkut displayed its name as Yogurt. Then April 1st, 2008, all featured videos on the UK and Australian homepage and later all international homepages of Google-owned YouTube linked to a video of Rick Astley's song, Never Gonna Give You Up, causing all users of the website who clicked on featured videos to be Rickrolled. That was the first year YouTube participated in Google's April 1st Day tradition. Then in 2009, the announcement of Caddy, C-A-D-I-E, was made March 31st, 2009 at 11:59 by the Caddy team, not on April 1st. Introduction page and all the references to Caddy and Google's products was taken down on April 2nd and placed with a message stating, we apologize for the recent disruption to our services. Please stand by. Well, the Google has had many pranks that they have played. So who says a company doesn't have a sense of humor? All right. All that having been said, and it having taken up a good bit of our showtime, I'm going to go back to Secrets of World War II. And one of the many failed experiments of World War II was the glider infantry. When airborne units were first raised, it quickly realized that there'd not be enough transport aircraft to deliver all the paratroopers that could be trained. And frankly, heavy weapons couldn't be delivered by parachute. Noting the Germans used a lot of gliders, the Allies began raising glider regiments. Only the three assigned to the 82nd, the 101st, and those in British service saw much action. With 1,600 troops, the glider regiments didn't have much more firepower than the parachute regiments. Gliders were able to put the regiment's four 37mm anti-tank guns and 18 81mm mortars on the ground. You can also land the occasional jeep. And since the gliders literally crash-landed, casualties were higher than with the paratroopers. And the gliders were, for the most part, lost during the landing process. And there was a spirited debate made about what the glider pilots were supposed to do once they landed. The British formed their glider pilots into companies of infantry. The U.S. glider pilots, being of relatively higher NCO rank, were generally left at loose ends with the units they landed with. The question is, what now? Well, there had been a lot of talk about American women in uniform. You know, although about 3,500 women were enrolled as nurses and three actually commissioned as medical officers in the Union Confederate armies during the Civil War, women were first regularly enlisted in the U.S. Armed Forces early in the 20th century. And shortly after the century began, the Army Nurses Corps and the Navy Nurse Corps were founded. These were specialized, highly professional organizations. Initially, the women enrolled were actually not considered members of the armed forces. But before World War I, their status was clarified, and they were looked at as officers. During World War I, this notion of women in uniform began to be taken seriously. During the war, nearly 50,000 American women served in some capacity, in addition to the Army Nurses Corps, which grew from 400 to 20,000, and the Navy Nurses Corps, which grew from 460 to 1,400. Over 11,000 women were enlisted as yeomanettes in the Navy. Thousands more served in the Army as clerical workers, switchboard operators, and the like, and there were even a few hundred Marinettes. Aside from the Nurse Corps, most of the women were not formally recognized to perform military duties despite the fact they were in uniform, served more or less under military discipline, and often worked under the same conditions as did the male personnel beside whom they served. It wasn't until years later the women were accorded the status of veterans. The American Expeditionary Force's 1,500 women telephone operators were designated that status only in the mid-1980s. Now, the AEF was World War I. After World War I, women were once again excluded from the service except in the two nurse corps. By 1939, there were barely 1,000 women in uniform. And as the nation began to expand its military forces, the number of women in uniform began to rise once again. Initially, the armed forces weren't enthusiastic about expanding the role of women in the services. But as manpower became increasingly scarce, the idea of enrolling a large number of women became increasingly attractive. In fact, in 1942, the enlistment of women began in earnest under the slogan, Free a Man to Fight. And by the end of the war, there were 350,000 American women that had served in uniform. Now, in the Army, there were three distinct ways in which women could serve, and over 200,000 did, including several thousand black women who served as in segregated units. About 60,000 women served as officer nurses in the Army Nurse Corps. There was the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. About 140,000 women were enrolled in a new separate emergency branch of the Army. They served in a lot of ways, truck drivers, hospital orderlies, aviation mechanics. Before the war ended, this became the Women's Army Corps, part of the regular establishment. Women's Air Service Pilots, or the WASP, under the leadership of famed aviatrix Jacqueline Cochran, who had early served as a ferry pilot for the RAF, about 1,000 women were enrolled as pilots. They ferried aircraft of all kinds, including B-17s, throughout the United States and occasionally overseas as well. In the Navy, about 150,000 women served during the war, including Marines and Coast Guard. 114,000 women served in the Navy Nurse Corps. Then there were the Women's Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, or the WAVES. About 100,000 women served in a variety of duties, much as did their sisters in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. Several women served as air navigators and as such became the first women permitted to serve in airplane crews. The war's end. By that time, the emergency had been dropped from their title. WAVES made up 55% of the personnel at the headquarters of the Department of the Navy. The Marines were the last service to enlist women, creating the Women's Reserve, which had no cute acronym, in 1943. About 23,000 women served there. Although women Marines received more weapons training, their actual duties didn't differ materially from those that are sisters in the other services. Then the Coast Guard. The SPARs, as they were called, From the motto of the Coast Guard, Sempre Paratus, Latin for always prepared. But the spars enrolled a total of 13,000 women in the course of the war, who performed what was maybe the broadest range of duties of any women in uniform. From radar operators to carpenter's mates, with some even serving afloat. It's interesting to note that early in the war, due to a peculiarity of naval regulations, women officers were supposed to be addressed as sir. Now, this was universally ignored. Ma'am was the preferred form and eventually found its way into the regs. The average age of women entering the service in the two nurse corps was 25. That of the women in the other branches, 23 and a half. As a group, the women in the service were better educated than their male counterparts, a surprising proportion of whom, nearly 20%, were found to be functionally illiterate. Army and Navy nurses, of course, were all nursing school graduates. The other female personnel, 7% were college graduates, 15% had some college, 41% had completed high school, and 32% had some high school. Only 6% had never been to high school. Most of the women who entered the service seemed to have been from middle-class backgrounds. About a third had fathers who were managers or professionals, a considerably higher proportion than the nation's norm. Over 8% of the women didn't feel their families had been worse off than average during the Great Depression, and only 40% came from small-town or rural backgrounds. About 67% of the women were Protestants, 5% were Jewish, 25% were Catholic. The latter two groups being overly represented in proportion to their percentage of the American population as a whole at that time. Although most of the women in question were single, a few were married. About 86% of the WACs were single upon enlistment, but about 7% of single women married while in the service. Of married WACs, about 30% had husbands who were not in the service. Of those who had husbands who were in the service, 58% had husbands who were overseas during the war. Unlike some of their sisters in the Soviet Army and in many of the European resistance movements, American women did not actively engage in combat. However, except for the resistance movements, uniformed women worldwide tended to be kept out of combat. Although the Soviets had many all-female combat units, including tank battalions, at the beginning of the war, these were quickly disbanded or sent to quiet sectors. Once the fighting got going in earnest, many Soviet Army women were in danger. Thousands served in traffic control and air defense units, both of which exposed the women to enemy fire. Women were used in highly trained sniper units, where many won decorations for bravery. The Germans also used thousands of women in air defense units in Germany, and these outfits suffered heavy casualties to end the war when Allied aircraft were numerous enough to go after flak positions. Well, overall, the performance of American women in the armed forces during the war was outstanding, despite considerable harassment and ridicule. Not only did they serve in every theater of war, but many did so with distinction under fire, and a number even got the Bronze Star. Several were taken prisoner, and a number were killed in the line of duty. And so pleased with the brass with the performance of the women, they proposed to draft as many as 1.5 million women if the war lasted into 1946. When peace came, women more than held their own as personnel strength was reduced, so that there were proportionally far more women in uniform after the war than before. Well, certainly there's a lot of little facts about World War II that very few people know about. But for now, we've come to the end of another show. I hope you enjoyed the information about April Fools. So until tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.